It's the Burt Cohen Show. And if we start losing our freedoms, what happens to the dream? How important is freedom of speech to being an American? Well, I don't know about you, but boy, I think it's pretty important. And things get bad when there's a chilling of freedom of speech going on. And I think, unfortunately, there has been a little bit of chilling of freedom of speech when it comes to criticizing the policies of the state of Israel. A lot of people around the world, including the U.S., have been pretty upset about what Israel did in Gaza. It seems kind of out of keeping with Jewish tradition of ethics and morals. And concern has been raised about what they've done and how it affects Judaism. Zionism, of course, is not the same thing as Judaism, but unfortunately, it seems most of the world thinks it is. And there have been demonstrations, particularly in Europe, and an apparent rise in anti-Semitism in Europe over the summer since the Israeli war on Gaza. And I kind of thought, well, frankly, I'm not surprised. You know, people tend to see Judaism as the same thing. And of course, people were greatly upset by what Israel did. And frankly, I thought about writing a letter to the New York Times. I didn't. But we have a guest today who did and who said, I think, what was on a lot of people's minds. Our guest today is the Reverend Bruce Shipman. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
And the Reverend Shipman, Bruce Shipman, I guess I'll call you Bruce, resigned from his post as priest in charge of the Episcopal Church in Yale, down in New Haven, in early September, 2 weeks after his remarks in a New York Times letter garnered national media attention for their alleged, and I emphasize alleged, anti-Semitism. In an August 21st letter responding to the letter, Emory professor, he responded to this. Deborah Lipstadt's August 20th New York Times essay was titled, "Why Jews Are Worried." Shipman put forth his idea that Israel's actions in Gaza contributed to growing anti-Semitism in Europe. Seems pretty clear to me. Bruce Shipman served parishes in New York and Connecticut and has just been named Vicar, or is it Vicar? I guess Vicar.
Emeritus.
Yes, Vicar Emeritus. Sorry about that. Being a
simple nomenclature.
Well, being a heathen, what do I know? Of the Church of the Holy Advent in Clinton, Connecticut. He served as Episcopal chaplain at Yale for many years and was forced to resign for that letter, which disturbed me and disturbed a lot of people, I think. Forced to resign for writing a letter. Reverend Shipman, Bruce, thanks for being with us. What was your purpose in writing the letter? And if you could, just tell us how it came about. I'm sure you didn't do it without a great deal of thought and consideration.
I am a letter writer. I get exercised over issues that I care deeply about. And I put my thoughts into writing, and that's how I deal with it. I've done that all of my life, all my ministry. I'm upset, concerned about something, or overjoyed about something, and I put it into writing, and I often send off letters to newspapers. Most are not published, but some are, and that's the way I have functioned for much of my life, and I've been very upset about the Gaza war, and I love the Middle East dearly. I lived there as a boy. I have made many trips to Israel and to Palestine and the West Bank, and this recent round of violence has been so much on my mind that I sat down to write this letter as some kind of response to Dr. Lipstadt's article all about why Jews are worried and the increase of anti-Semitism in Europe and beyond. That's a little background.
And
do you want me to read the letter?
Yes, please, if you could. That would be great. Thank you.
It's really quite short, and I never dreamed there'd be such an uproar, you know, caused by it. And this is the August 26th edition of the New York Times. To the editor, Deborah E. Lipstadt makes far too little of the relationship between Israel's policies in the West Bank and Gaza and growing anti-Semitism in Europe and beyond. The trend to which she alludes parallels the carnage in Gaza over the last 5 years, not to mention the perpetually stalled peace talks and the continuing occupation of the West Bank. As hope for a two-state solution fades and Palestinian casualties continue to mount, the best antidote to anti-Semitism would be for Israel's patrons abroad to press the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu final status resolution to the Palestinian question. Signed, Reverend Bruce M. Shipman.
And that's it.
That's it. That's the letter.
Gee, nothing in there sounds all that, frankly, earth-shaking to me. But
well, I didn't think so either. In fact, the Hartford Courant this morning addressed the issue, and they said that they found the letter anodyne. I had to go to my dictionary.
Yeah, what does that mean, please?
But rather bland, rather unexciting.
Well, it's funny. It's funny, but when you think about it, something that anodyne, I guess, could cause that much of an uproar and result, I mean, what scares me, and I think most, you know, patriotic, participatory citizens, is a chilling of freedom of speech.
Well, that is my concern, too, that it will inhibit people from speaking what they believe or raising questions about what they don't know, you know. We need to discuss these issues now, and it's in the public interest to do so. And there must be no attempt, you know, to blacken, tarnish reputations or assassinate characters by suggesting that there are things that can be done to make it better.
Of course. Tell us about the process through which Yale decided to push you out.
I have to explain a few things. Yale did not push me out.
Okay.
I was the Episcopal chaplain at Yale, and I served as one of probably close to 30 chaplains who are recognized by the university chaplain and allowed to function as chaplains and to worship on the Yale campus. So I was not hired or employed by the university. I was employed by the Episcopal Church at Yale. They are the ones who appointed me with the Bishop of Connecticut and the ones to whom I am accountable. But we also functioned, all of the chaplains function at Yale under the umbrella of the Yale Religious Ministries, which is the grouping of the chaplains under the university chaplain. There is an official university chaplain whose name is Sharon Kugler, who is paid by the university and appointed by the president. And she kind of keeps peace among the chaplains, and she oversees the religious ministries, is a kind of dean of religious life at the college and the university. She does not function liturgically so much, but she does oversee. So it was not the university that fired me, not at all, but there was pressure put by the university on my bishop. I'm quite sure he has not said this to me, and so this mm-hmm. is not, you know, this is speculation. But I know the university was actively contacting persons involved behind the scenes. They did not really welcome my message, and they thought that I ought not to continue. And they objected also to using the Yale name in my letter. Well, that is my title. You know, I think that raises also a question. Am I allowed, as a chaplain, to say who I am when I write a letter on public policy? I did not in any way claim to be representing the chaplaincy in my letter. It was me speaking. But that was my title until 2 weeks ago, the Episcopal chaplain at Yale. But the fact that there was that association with the university did make many people read it more closely, and many were alarmed by what they saw between the lines. I think that's that's safe to say. And they, too, had confusion, you know, am I writing on behalf of the university, on behalf of the Episcopal students, or is it just my opinion? And it was my opinion.
Of course.
But that was my title, and had I not used my title, I'm sure someone not liking that it would have outed me and said, he is the Episcopal chaplain, here he is trying to get away with something, you know. So the question is, do I have a right, you know, to make a pronouncement of any sort on a public issue that is somewhat controversial? I think I do.
Wow.
And I came of age in the 60s when civil rights and the Vietnam War were very big issues, and clergy were encouraged to take a stand and to stick their necks out on behalf of the underdog, certainly in Vietnam. And civil rights movement was deeply grounded in the churches of America, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Sure.
Martin Luther King, I mean, the stories that inspired the Exodus story, the stories that made the civil rights movement so compelling and so right, wholly apart from its constitutional mandate. I mean, all of this was part of my formation, and I can't imagine functioning as a chaplain without the right to speak and write on issues of the day and the Holy Land. It is my Holy Land as well as the Jews' Holy Land and the Muslims' Holy Land.
Mm-hmm.
My Holy Land is a subject of great concern to me just now.
I am sure.
And that's why I wrote the letter. And I don't think it was improper to identify who I was.
It amazes me. I mean, of course. And, I mean, that was your title. I guess it's not right now.
It was my title.
It was your title. And
but also, I have to say, Bob, that the chaplain of the university rebuked me for not clearing this first with her. And again, that raises a question.
Whoa.
You know, what is this understanding? You know, what is this?
Well, I've been to... there's so many things. I've been to an awful lot of religious institutions, and it seems to me one consistent thing is that the preachers, the ministers, the priests, the rabbis, they are entrusted by the congregation to speak from the heart, to base whatever they say on their interpretation of what that religion, that faith is all about, and to speak out. They are, gosh, last time I checked, expected to speak out.
Thank you for saying that, because that's my understanding, too.
We have people on the right, people on the left, who base their beliefs in their religion and their ethics, and I the idea of clearing it with your superiors, somebody in your position.
Something new to me.
So that is out of the ordinary, having to clear it with your superior. I just can't really.
I can't imagine it either. And the same is true at the monthly meeting. The university chaplain convenes a monthly gathering of the chaplains at Yale.
Uh-huh.
And again, it's a big group. There must be 30-some people there representing, you know, all the spectrum of religious groups, from the Mormons to the Buddhists, Muslims on campus, and Episcopalians as well. But when she asked us, I went to the Holy Land in March with a group from the Yale Divinity School and from the Episcopal Church at Yale, and we spent a good deal of time in Bethlehem and in the West Bank. And so when Chaplain Cougar asked us to talk about how we'd spent spring break, I told her about the trip that I'd taken with some students and how troubled we were by the settlement activity that we observed and some, you know, the highway system, which is really the separation wall, you know, separating Bethlehem from Jerusalem and keeping the people there really in, you know, unable to get to their jobs easily. And it was all very disturbing, and I described this, and I said that so many of our people came away thinking it's almost too late for a two-state solution.
Yeah, I wonder about that myself, I have to say.
Afterwards, she rebuked me for saying this, and she said that subject must never come up at these meetings. I said, Sharon, you asked us to talk about spring break and what we've done. That subject must not come up. Now, does it mean? Is the touch between the chaplain so fragile and so thin that we cannot say what we've seen and how we feel? What is that? What kind of chaplaincy is that? So this is a very real question, but that was, you know, that was back in April, and I think that's all background to what's just happened.
We are, I'm amazed here at some of the language that was used. The repression of freedom of speech is just, it's so blatant and really, I guess medieval might be an appropriate word. I don't know, but it sure doesn't sound like the Episcopalian Church with which I've been.
It's not that I expected to find at Yale University among the chaplains, you know. And if the unity is so fragile that we can't say what concerns us, what kind of unity is that?
Well,
and if the chaplain, if the head chaplain expects us to be spending our time only on pastoral care, which is very important,
yeah,
but to keep our mouths shut on anything that might be controversial, that is a travesty of our calling.
I can't imagine. As you know, Reverend Shipman, Bruce Shipman, that, you know, by working in the New Hampshire State Senate, I got to know I was very much close with the Episcopal Church here, from Doug Thuner and, of course, Gene Robinson. And it's a wonderful tradition. I mean, they speak out. You know,
we're known as being mavericks, you know. And yet, people of integrity and conscience that, I've understood my calling to be giving voice to the underdog. And, you know, it is my hope that back in the late 30s, I would have had the courage to speak out in Germany. I would have had the courage to speak out. That is my hope. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer and some of the good Germans that that not only risked their lives, but gave their lives and went to prison, you know. I would hope that I would have been among them. But in the same way today, I think that the Palestinians need a voice. You know, they're the ones who are being misrepresented and demonized. And I really do feel that it is my calling to let people know that these two are children of Abraham. They're our cousins. It's family. You know, we are all related spiritually through Abraham, and that region is holy to all three religions. And it's a family feud. These are not evil terrorists. Of course, there are evil terrorists among them, but that's true of every group.
Mm-hmm. True.
And the kind of disinformation and the fear and the Islamophobia that I see is something I feel that I must address.
Yeah, there's a tradition at Yale. A friend went to Yale and lived for a semester in the basement of, you know who I'm going to say, William Sloan Coffin.
Of course.
Bill Coffin, as he writes, was not afraid to offend people.
In fact,
he thought that it was part of his job as chaplain. Prophets are supposed to make people uncomfortable.
The old saying is, afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, Coffin, I mean, he offered to resign. I mean, many benefactors, many alumni, many big givers were deeply offended by his positions on the Vietnam War, but he offered to resign to President Brewster, and his resignation was turned down.
Well, what's changed, I wonder? Is it the power of the so-called Jewish lobby, AIPAC? I mean, that is, frankly, a subject that
I don't worry about AIPAC. I mean, that New Yorker article, September 1st.
Tell us about
Connie
that.
Brooke, about the reach of AIPAC is genuinely troubling, and I think it needs to be discussed.
Tell us about it for people who haven't read it.
Oh, it's a very long piece.
Well, it's the New Yorker.
It confirms what I had known, but more so. And it's a very important piece. And it's important also because David Remnick, the editor of the New Yorker, is a brilliant man. He is a liberal Zionist. He is, and therefore he is not, you know, he is not afraid to criticize Israel where he thinks Israel is going wrong. And he believes at this time that it's important to have that essay in the New Yorker. And so I think at some great personal cost, he had it published by Connie Brooke. But it tells about the reach of AIPAC and how AIPAC gives money to all the candidates.
All of them.
And so that virtually everyone in Congress is taking money from AIPAC, beholden to AIPAC.
Yep.
You know? And AIPAC is formulating policy frequently and telling them how to vote, and very often they don't have the the motivation, the time, the background to do much research, and they go the easy way, and let AIPAC determine the policies. Well, that can't continue, you know, that can't continue, and especially with regard to Iran, our policy toward Iran, we cannot let AIPAC and policies made in Tel Aviv be determining American policies in that part of the world. There's too much at stake. That has to end. And I just think, ask your congressman, how much are you taking from AIPAC? How much are you beholden to them?
Right.
And I think campaign finance reform is the most critical issue facing America right now.
No question.
We want to have a true democracy. We have got to change the campaign financing, which is corrupting through and through.
Yeah, no question. And AIPAC, American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, every single U.S. senator, even, you know, the people on the most left, Bernie Sanders and others, they vote with AIPAC. The power is
still
just
taking money from AIPAC.
Absolutely. The power is
and that is appalling. And the fact that AIPAC often can swing elections one way or the other,
often,
you know, and have done so. And all of this is documented carefully by Connie Buck in that article. It needs to be taken seriously.
And what's most concerning is the effect on chilling of speech. They call it civility, that if you speak out, it's been called uncivil. There was an example at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. They used the excuse of civility to get rid of a popular professor, Stephen Salata, for his criticisms of Israel's actions in Gaza.
I've heard that, yeah.
Universities are supposed to be places where free speech is celebrated. And the last time I checked, the First Amendment is there not to protect, you know, calm, inoffensive speech. The purpose of the First Amendment is to protect what may be offensive speech. And this is some scary stuff.
I would guess that what I found at Yale is true on most leading campuses, that there is a great deal of self-censorship going on.
Yes.
You know, and that beneath the surface, there's a whole other struggle going on, but people are afraid to name it. They're afraid to name the powers, they're afraid to name the issues, and that is very troubling.
Well, as you can imagine, for people like me, my last name is Cohen. You know that's a Jewish name. Not everybody does.
Priestly name. It's a priestly name.
Of course it is.
Proud.
Cohen, absolutely.
Yeah.
I am thrilled to have that.
You're noble.
Well, thank you so much. Everybody. No. But, you know, there is pressure on us. You know, a lot of many Jews are afraid to speak out. And we have had a long liberal tradition.
I know. I mean, Jewish values have formed me on most every issue. My natural allies are members of the Jewish community. This is the people that I go to.
And in the civil rights struggle in Vietnam.
Of course.
And the very fact that, you know, very few columnists or just citizens dare criticize Israel for fear of being called anti-Semitic. It's a terrible, chilling.
Self-hating. You're a self-hating Jew.
Right. I had a guy
dismissing an intelligent point of view with something like that. It's a profound injustice.
Yes, it is. And I had a fellow on recently, Eric Mann, who has a new phrase. He calls himself a self-respecting Jew, and that's you got to work on the language here. And you know what concerns me, and I think some of the concern that was raised, suggesting that, you know, it's not to justify anti-Semitism in Europe. And I actually hear that from a listener that he goes to the protests. He's in Europe and he protests against Israeli policies every week. He sees no actual anti-Semitism. He writes that, quote, in Europe, we understand the difference between Judaism and Zionism.
Yeah.
Maybe the newspapers, the New York Times in specific, simply got it wrong. Because after all, many Jews in Europe participate in the protests. This European says the protests are not anti-Semitic, just anti-Zionism. And here in America, nearly everyone conflates the two, Judaism and Zionism. That easy conflation seems to
must be opposed. You know, that must end. That must end.
And how do we do that? Because people are saying, you know, if you criticize Israel, well, you're anti-Semitic, which is, of course, nuts.
That must end. It just means that good people, honest people like you and me, must must speak the truth and, you know, and sit down civilly at the table as well. And I had a very nice evening last Friday. I was invited to the Jewish Society at Yale, which is headed by an Orthodox rabbi, Rabbi Shmuley Hecht. And he's very conservative on these issues, but he insisted that we sit down at the table over wonderful food and drink, meet as persons, and respect each other and discuss our differences. And it was the most wonderful evening. There were about 30 people, from professors from Yale and undergraduates, graduate students, a wonderful mix of people, but we all sat and talked and met as friends face to face, and that's how it should be. Sure. But to end this linkage between, you know, anti-Semitism and criticism of Israel, that is wrong. That's a disservice, and that must end.
Well, it does.
And now is the time. I mean, I think this issue, why my letter lit such a firestorm, it just was a little spark. There were fumes in the air and gasoline on the ground that caught fire because it's on people's minds. And I've been getting a great deal of mail saying, thank you for saying what we all know is true, but we're afraid to say it.
Right.
You know, I wasn't aware of being especially courageous in sending off my letter at 11 p.m. the other night. But I just felt that I wanted to get it off my chest, so I sent it off to the Times. And all of this developed. But the fact that so many people feel this way, but are afraid to talk about it, that's unhealthy, that's dangerous.
Yes.
To push it underground is even more dangerous because it's going to come back in very bad ways to haunt, and the real antisemitism could result, and we don't want that, you know.
Yeah.
Because friends and members of the family who grieve to see bad decisions and a kind of arrogance of power leading to places that are not good, that are without hope. We want to keep hope alive, and that means a little imagination and a little goodwill to move things forward in a way that gives Israel a future. At this point, there's just endless war, and they become more frequent. You know, this is no future. Armed superiority is no future. That's no life. That's no way for them to live, and that's a fundamental corruption of Jewish values, and Israel is meant to enshrine and preserve Jewish values.
And it's certainly the case, Bruce Shipman, that Israel itself, they're really very much involved in an awful lot of self-defense, as it were.
They are.
And part of it...
My letter wouldn't lift an eyebrow in Haaretz.
Well, I think they can be blamed to a large extent because they have very diligently, persistently, and effectively worked to paint the picture that Jews and the state of Israel are one identity. So therefore, it's been extremely powerful, extremely effective, that you can't criticize the state of Israel, because if you say anything against the state of Israel, you're anti-Semitic. Well, that's frankly crazy.
That's wrong, and that has to end.
Yes.
And the truth is that it is American money, and that,
yes,
you know, that is enabling Israel to pursue some of its most destructive policies. And that's why, as Americans, we must be concerned as well. How is our money being used? The military aid, the highways in the West Bank that are for settler use only, the illegal settlements are, many of them, underwritten by money from the United States. You know, this is deeply troubling, and our own national interests are involved there, too.
No, it's true. They wouldn't do it without. They couldn't do it without. And the people there know it. I mean, if we want to ensure more hatred of America, we'll just keep doing what we're doing. You know, it's and Israel, I mean, how they could think, I mean, just strategically, forgetting any moral principles, which quite frankly are meaningful to me and to you as people who care about, you know, spirituality, it's dumb policy to make people so angry that future generations now, of course, they're going to do whatever they can to, you know, take on Israel and make a two-state solution.
And that's a tragedy.
Ah.
And that is a tragedy, and that's why I do grieve. I grieve,
yes,
as for a beloved family member. You know, the way it's gone, the fact is that Israel didn't really... Anti-Semitism was largely unknown in the Arab world until 1948.
They lived together in peace for a long time before the Zionist movement came in.
And since 1948, 48, it's been,
And when you treat people as less than, that's out of the Jewish tradition. That is out of the, I'm sure, Episcopal tradition.
Of course it
is. So how could you not speak out, you know?
Of course.
And I think what's interesting is, you know, oftentimes it takes stirring things up, a controversy, to wake people up, to open people's eyes. Maybe that the fact that, that your brief, what was anodyne?
My anodyne. I love that word.
I know. Your brief.
My active vocabulary from now on.
Oh, I know. I'm loving it here. Stirring things up. You know, maybe that'll make a difference. I wonder, you know, I recently, since the very tragic death of Robin Williams, I saw I saw the Dead Poets Society. And,
oh, I love that. Yeah.
And kids at the end stood up in support of the fired Robin Williams.
Well, I thought of him. I thought of him. That's one of my favorite films. I thought of him in all of this.
Did I imagine some? I mean, you knew a lot of students. What's the reaction on the campus there?
Oh, I think bewildered and troubled, you know. And they see it. Even I got a nice letter the other day from a senior. In fact, he's a senior this year. You know, I just fellowship, and I didn't agree with your letter. He said. But I just am so shocked that that this has happened, you know, and free speech is an issue. I don't understand how this could happen.
Yeah, free speech.
I think that that is the feeling among many. And,
well, did you resist leaving? You just, was there...
Quite frankly, my own board did not support me.
Ooh.
There are disappointments on many levels, but it was not Yale that fired me. I mean,
right.
Yale did put pressure. The administration did put pressure on the Episcopal leadership of Connecticut and on the board of the Episcopal Church at Yale.
Hmm.
And the board, not unanimous by any means, and the board did not have the authority to fire me, but they did make known. The executive committee, who are the actual decision makers, the treasurer, the officers, made it known that they felt that I should leave for the good of ECY, that I should leave and offer my resignation, and if not, they should demand it.
Hmm.
That was not ever taken to a vote, but the members of that committee were unanimous and was presented as such. And the bishop accepted that. You know, how could I possibly work, you know, without
yes, of course.
Of key people on the board?
Of course.
And the bishop, the following day, I offered my resignation, and he said he was disappointed, but he accepted it.
Yeah.
And there would have been other possibilities, but at this point, I really wanted to be as clean as possible. I had no idea, again, that there would be so much fallout from my leaving. I guess I didn't imagine that. Hmm. You know, I was there for a 2-year contract, which was to help to put the house in order in preparation for a more permanent chaplain. And I did not expect that it would cause such a great deal of controversy that I should leave under those circumstances.
So
it has. It has, and I'm determined that some good shall come out of it.
Yes.
And that means that this issue must not be kept underground. It must not be off limits to open civil discourse, but must be in the open air. And great universities must invite dialogue and conversation using their best minds to throw light on how we got where we are and on new ways to deal with the conflict, you know, new ways for American power and influence to be deployed, to provide some options, some hope, something that offers a future. Because the present way is not offering a future at all. It's endless war.
Yeah.
And two people locked in a terrible conflict in which each is struggling to the death. You know, it doesn't have to be that way.
No.
But those Palestinians deserve a voice. I mean, they deserve to be acknowledged as human beings. There are over 4 million in Gaza and the West Bank. That's, you know, it's demographically, it's a huge presence, but they must be acknowledged, and their stories must be respected, and the dignity given back to them, and the possibility of possessing some of the land. I mean, it must be shared.
Yes.
Both have compelling stories. The land must be shared if there's to be any kind of peace in the future.
Well, we'll see if that's still possible. If you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is the Reverend Bruce Shipman, who recently resigned his post as priest in charge of the Episcopal Church at Yale after writing a bland, perhaps, letter.
Anodyne.
I love it. Letter in the New York Times. And it seems there was a great quote from Bob Dylan who said, "Money doesn't talk, it swears." He had some great lines. As a singer, he's a good songwriter, okay? But I can't help but think that the power of AIPAC, able to raise tremendous amount of money, the power of money is squashing free speech. And I have no doubt that at Yale, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where they fired somebody for speaking out for being uncivil, as if criticizing Israel was outside the bounds of civility, that the money is involved. That I can't help but think that the administrators thought, oh, if they allow these people, that particular professor, Stephen Salata, and you, even though Yale didn't have direct authority over you, to continue, their funding might dry up. Now, what does that say about freedom of speech here in America?
Well, that's true, because I know I received letters from some very powerful people. At least the address and the titles sounded quite powerful, in which they said immediately they would be contacting the president and the trustees, and that the big money was involved. You know, if I were to stay in that position, you know, it was not even veiled.
Wow! So you saw actual letters where people with nice sounding
with clout and connection to Yale intended to use their power that I would not stay.
Wow! That is absolute.
I still have them on the internet. I'm not imagining. I erased some of the uglier ones. But I also kept some that are there, you know. It's not my imagination.
No, I'm sure it's not. And Winston Churchill said, if you're a public official and you're not making some people angry, you're not doing your job.
There's some comfort in that. In some ways, I'm growing into my clerical collar, even in my old age. I'm earning it.
It is.
Paying my dues.
You know, and there were... there was a large ad in the New York Times recently, that paper keeps coming up somehow, signed by over 350 Holocaust survivors, Jewish people protesting against what Israel is doing. Yeah. They say calling their objections to Israel brutality anti-Semitic is a cruel perversion of the term. And there's another reaction. There's the book came out, I don't know, 20 some years ago called Maus. It was like the first graphic novel, and it's a classic about the horrors of the Holocaust. Its creator, Art Spiegelman, recently spoke out. I love this quote. He says, "Israel is like some badly battered child with PTSD who has grown up to batter others." There've been an end of quote. There were some other examples in the state of Israel calling for the total destruction of the Palestinian people, and Israel calls to quote exterminate the enemy and refer to them as snakes and vermin. That sounds way too familiar. Do we not have a responsibility to speak out against that?
I'm sorry.
Do we not have a responsibility
to? We do. Of course we do.
And Jews too.
That's an extremist fringe in Israel, I know.
Well.
But Avigdor Lieberman, I mean, there are people who are really, you know, they think rather like the old Stalinists, frankly. It's disturbing. But of course we must speak out. Of course. And Israel, that does not represent Israeli thinking at all.
Right. And
Israel has a very lively and intellectually vigorous press and public debate on all issues. And that's a wonderful thing. And I do count on that, just as I do here, talking to you and so many Jewish friends and others here. I quote them. You know, these are the ones that know more than I do on the subject. And I think Tony Jude, the late Tony Jude, you know him.
Don't.
A most extraordinary man, a scholar at New York University, who died recently of ALS, died very heroically of ALS. But he... also took the view that we share with regard to having to rein in Israel's nationalistic excesses. And he took some abuse for that. He's such a noble and courageous man, and there are so many others.
And for people to say, I had one letter to me saying, you know, they praise your courage. Well, what does that say that it takes courage to?
Well, that's what I see. That's a serious question. Why should it take courage to write an anodyne letter like mine?
It's. But it's true. Why should it take courage? What does that say? Isn't that...
You would be, you know, again, I've kept all these emails.
Yes, you should.
You know, the number that said, thank you for your courage, we're proud of you. You know, I'm not a hero. I was just, you know, sounding off as I do at night, saying what I think, and, you know, I had no idea that there'd be such a response. I had no idea.
And I have to tell you, in all personal sincerity, I had written a letter to the New York Times about how Judaism is not Zionism, they're not one and the same, and that a lot of Jews are against this stuff. I have to confess, I chickened out. And what does that say? And how do I feel about that? You know, the powers are intense, especially me being Jewish. I mean, I have differences in my family, my own, you know, immediate family. There's strong differences of opinion among the four kids. There's two on one side, two on the other. And it's some tough stuff. But I think it was said somewhere that, you know, if we don't protest loudly enough, we're inviting anti-Semitic attacks on ourselves. And there's this sin of silence that came out of World War II, the sin of silence, how important it is to speak out. And right now, you know, we have something called Islamophobia. It's been on the rise for a long time. Of course, the bad guys are a tiny minority of Muslims who commit these acts. Just like that Kansas church that has, you know, the horrible protest. They call themselves Christians, but they're a tiny minority. And yet, in the United States, appears to be a growing antipathy toward all Muslims, and that's kind of dangerous, and it seems kind of similar.
Yes, and that's why I really want to try to give voice to their concerns and let them know. I've had some very heartwarming letters from members of the Muslim community who thanked me, and one said, you know, it is people like you who keep alive our faith in the religious community, because so many keep silent. You know, they will read the Word of God in their worship on Fridays and Saturdays and Sundays. When it comes to speaking out or taking a stand, we don't hear from them. But they thanked me for my modest contribution. But that's important. It's important, I think.
Yeah, and we have to not just, it seems to me, not just, you know, worship, but actually try to live the principles in our lives? I mean...
Absolutely.
It doesn't seem...
Absolutely, and that's why I do try to... when I preach, I always point out the parallels between Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. You know, we're cut from the same cloth. We came to life in the same land.
Yes.
And it is our holy land together. It's a family feud, you know. The differences, it's a family feud. There are some cultural differences, but it's in the family. It's in the household of faith. It's important to stress that, you know, otherwise you hear such ugly distortions of the truth about Islam's vision of hate and violence. I mean, you know, you can find passages in Joshua or in, you know, in all of the Bible, you can find ugly passages that can be misused, you know. I mean, they say the devil quotes scripture for his own purposes.
I heard that.
And it can happen. And it does happen.
Oh, yes. It certainly does. Well, there's a Rabbi Leah Cohen, which my daughter is Leah Cohen, but it's not her. My daughter's much younger. She is a rabbi, a chaplain at Yale. She wrote, on this campus, we draw upon the cherished principles of freedom of expression and our rich and deep relationships to promote respectful conversations that matter. She implied that you were somehow justifying anti-Semitism. Was your letter, I mean, what about that? Was your letter as charged a justification in any way for anti-Semitism? That's, I think, what the fear is, that by saying, well, if you criticize Israel, if you start there, it's a slippery slope to anti-Semitism in general.
Well, some people read it that way, and that came to me as a shock. But some did read it that way, and I had a meeting with Professor Morris Samuels, who is knowledgeable in anti-Semitism, and he explained to me why it could be read that way and why it seemed as if I was blaming the victim and why it seemed as if I was suggesting some kind of proportionality between anti-Semitism and the increase in violence in Europe directed at Jews and Jewish places of worship and property and what's happening in Israel-Palestine. I really wasn't saying that, but I said that there was a correlation between the two. But in the deeper conversation about anti-Semitism, I did not address that issue. I just thought there was a correlation between the two. And anyone looking for a deeper understanding of anti-Semitism as it has been practiced in the past, would have to look elsewhere. I know that the Sipka Center, which is the Jewish Center at Yale, sponsored a seminar on anti-Semitism yesterday, and Dr. Lipshaw was invited to speak, and it was partly because of my letter. I gather I was not invited, and I don't have the knowledge. I'm not a scholar in any way, and I don't know that much about anti-Semitism in its historic roots. But so I could understand that those who were offended felt that I had trivialized the subject by suggesting some kind of proportionality between the situation in Israel-Palestine and the uptick in anti-Semitic violence.
So what did you hear from that discussion?
Nothing. And also I sent an email to Rabbi Cohen saying I hoped that we could talk. I was aware that the letter had caused a huge reaction, and she did not reply. She would not meet with me. And that was a disappointment. And also James Ponette, the former rabbi who had been there for many years, and we developed Sipka Center and was a much loved and highly popular and effective chief Jewish chaplain. We had socialized last year, and I didn't hear a word from him either, and that was a disappointment.
Yeah, people really should meet.
And, times like this. But then the Jewish Society invited me for dinner on Friday, and a very wonderful evening with Rabbi Hecht, and, frank differences, but also deep respect and acknowledgement of each other's humanity. And that's what's important, That made up for it.
I'm reminded, of course, of the later 1960s when... if you protested America's war in Vietnam, there were a lot of people who said you were anti-American.
I was told that.
As was I.
I was told I should go to Russia.
But is it not true? My understanding is that it's dissent is absolutely deeply patriotic. It's a measure.
Of course it is. And we are children of Thoreau and Walden Pond. This is our heritage.
Absolutely.
As Americans, this is who we are. And that there is suddenly this fear, this timidity, this reticence about anything controversial, it's unhealthy, it's unreal, It harbors viruses that hatch in terrible ways. Bring it into the light. Bring it out. Get it out there. Say what you think. This self-censorship, this is not healthy. And it certainly does not belong at a good university.
And it seems to me, the suggestions that speaking out in this little letter was courage. In a better world, it shouldn't take that courage. We should all be free and comfortable to dissent and to speak out. I was amazed, during the war in Vietnam, how, the rabidness, to suggest that I was anti-American because I spoke out, it's deeply patriotic to do it.
And
you have done it too.
Another thing that really is a serious issue is why did some take such offense and why did so many take no offense at all? I mean, there's a huge gap of perception between most people I showed the letter to said, what's the fuss? I don't,
Yeah.
And yet, the respondents that sent a great deal of angry mail and that moved the powers at Yale, saw it as a very dangerous and an unacceptable letter. So there's a huge gap in it, and that needs to be addressed, I think.
Well, oftentimes people, as we know, fall into things in life. You know, you may intend one thing, but then it's kind of grace of God, I think, that people fall into things and end up doing things they didn't expect. Well, here you are. Quite frankly, Reverend Shipman, I hadn't heard of you before. Now I have. You know, and a lot of people have. So where do you go from here?
Well, frankly, you know, I do have a good deal of passion and energy for Middle Eastern issues. I love Islam. I love the worship. I love Judaism. I love the Holy Land. I love the region. I grieve at what's happening. I was in Syria just 6 years ago, and I never could have dreamed.
Oh, God, really?
You know, it's a wonderful land. It's so important. Yeah. Historically, religiously, Damascus, Aleppo, Damari, these wonderful places that are meaningful on the deepest level. But, you know, I do have opportunities to speak and to write, and so who knows? I see good coming out of this, and I that's what I have to believe, and I do believe it, that the entire subject can be approached with a little more openness and less fear. I think that that's a huge gain. If this is contributing in some small way to that, then I'm grateful, and it's worth it. And personally, I see opportunities to tell what I have seen and know to be true, and to hopefully, I would hope to be part of alternate ways of thinking and being that might help to bring a better resolution of the issues in Israel-Palestine.
And I certainly hope, in addition to the issues over there in Palestine-Israel, that here in the United States, once it gets too far, then our freedoms are gone. This is a wake-up call, it seems to me, that, you know, our freedoms to speak out are threatened, and it's not by, you know, the usual suspects, but, you know, this chilling of freedom of speech. Hello, people, wake up. We have to stand and defend this so that it's easier to speak out. It's more just a part of who we are as Americans. Always has been, and this is
we've got to wake up. And you're from the state, live free or die.
That's right. We are, and it's not too anodyne here. How can people keep up with you, with your work, if they want to get in touch? Is there something on the internet to which you can address them?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I'm not a blogger. You
right.
know, I do answer mail as best I can. It's been a lot lately.
I'll bet.
I don't know what to say. You know, I don't know what to say.
Well, I can just...
I don't have anything set up, you know, to handle.
Well, just the Reverend
handle,
Bruce Shipman.
You know, mail any volume or internet.
Well, be curious to see what the future holds for this issue. And for you, Bruce Shipman, thank you so much for being with us.
Mr. Cohen, for inviting me. I'm very grateful to have this chance to speak.
All right. Well, I like to speak, too. Speaking out is a good thing. Thanks very much. We're talking about freedom. Freedom.
Shuffling their feet, people sleeping in their shoes, but there's a warning sign on the road ahead. There's a lot of people saying we'd be better off dead. Don't feel like Satan, but I am to them, so I try to forget it any way I can. Keep on rocking in the free world. 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 with a baby in a hand, under an old street light, near a garbage can. Now she put the kid away and she's gone to get a hit. She hates her life and what she's done to it. That's one more kid that'll never go to school, never get to fall in love, never get to be cool. Keep on rocking in the free world. Keep on rocking in the free world. Keep on rocking in the free world. Keep on rocking in the free world.
And we have a responsibility to keep rocking in the free world. It's up to us, folks. Thanks for listening.